Today's episode is brought to you by Freetrade, the commission-free investment platform. Welcome to Many Happy Returns, where we aim to make you a better investor. I'm Robin.
And I'm Michael.
Many people criticise the Bank of England for its failure to foresee high inflation. A damning new review takes aim at the central bank's forecasting process and urges a major overhaul at Threadneedle Street.
I want to know if the old lady is stuck in her ways or if its poor performance is transitory. And in today's dumb question of the week, what is quantitative tightening? All right, let's get into it. So last year, the Bank of England commissioned a review into its forecasting process, and it's just received its report card, and it's not quite so positive as I imagine it was expecting. Now, Romin, of course, you've always been very positive about the Bank of England and its governor, Andrew Bailey. But did you agree with some of these findings?
Yeah, I thought it was very well reasoned. And I thought it was quite easy on the Bank of England in a way. It was very fact-based. There was no criticism of the Monetary Policy Committee.
Well, that was to do with the remit of the review. I think it wasn't to criticise the bank's policy decisions or anything like that. It was to say, how do they go about forecasting and is it the best way? And the report, when you read it, does go out of its way to sort of say all the staff at the bank are very hardworking and diligent. They're just sort of hamstrung by the tools at their disposal.
And the resources. I think they do have a resource constraint. You know, that's something we can talk about, but it's clear that they're not fully resourced, which is quite surprising when it's the foremost economic institution in the UK.
And they can print money. Just print the money and make the tools you need. Yeah.
Let's just print the money for the salaries.
I mean, this all came about in a way because the Bank of England was being criticised, as a lot of central banks were, for completely missing the spike in inflation and then going on to talk about it as transitory and something that was just going to pass through the system very quickly following the pandemic. Obviously, that didn't quite prove to be the case. And so they commissioned an independent review from Ben Bernanke, who used to run the Federal Reserve in America. Some people raised their eyebrows at that choice. He is very much a central bank insider.
And they all know each other. You bet they do. And of course, they're going to be kind of chummy. But would he hold back any criticism as a result of that? I doubt it. You know, I'd expect him to be quite professional about it and try to be objective at least.
I mean, there's one section of the report where he looks at the accuracy of the Bank of England's forecasts since 2015 and specifically in the pandemic period. And at least from his analysis, it seems they were very much in line with other central banks. You can't really point the finger at the Bank of England and say they were particularly bad here.
Yeah, the general pattern is that when inflation was reasonable and not surging, all central banks did a reasonable job of forecasting it because it didn't change much. There wasn't much of a job to do. But then during the pandemic, when we switched the economy off and on again, there was clearly a huge spike in inflation and they simply failed to see the scale of the inflation spike that followed, but also the duration, as you said. And that's not just for inflation. They also looked at GDP and unemployment, and it was a similar story.
So they compared the Bank of England's performance to six other central banks, including the Bank of Canada, the Federal Reserve in the US, the central banks in Norway and Sweden and New Zealand, and of course, the ECB in Europe. And like you say, the Bank of England's performance was kind of in the middle of the pack. When you look at inflation in the extreme spike, its forecasts were better than the ECB, but a little bit worse than Canada, Norway and New Zealand. So nothing exceptional. And they also compared it to external forecasts. You might just say, well, central banks as a group were bad forecasters in this period. But the report did look at external forecasts. And again, here it found that the Bank of England was kind of in line with the consensus of external forecasters. But that's not to say the bank is doing everything right when it comes to making economic forecasts.
And, you know, at the outset, I think I should say that I'm kind of on the Bank of England side here in the sense that if you haven't tried building your own model, forecasting things, you really shouldn't point the grubby finger of blame until you've tried it, because it's not easy to make a model which is robust and comes up with reasonable forecasts, because there's a lot of information you have to factor in. And the most difficult thing really is deciding what goes into the model. And then, you know, the analysis is actually not that difficult once you've decided what goes in. But I think a big part of it is also interpreting models and deciding how to use them. And I think one of the big differences between the Bank of England and, say, the Fed now, under Jerome Powell's leadership, is that the Federal Reserve is much less model dependent. It's a lot more based on their judgment, and the models certainly inform their judgment, but they don't have such a large part to play, I don't think, as they used to.
Do you mean in terms of setting the interest rate?
Yeah.
Because it's interesting that the Bank of England did hike before the Fed when inflation started to pick up. They moved first.
And that's unusual. Usually it's the Fed that goes first, then the Bank of England, then the ECB, both on the way in and on the way out. But this time around, that wasn't the case.
I think in terms of public perception of the Bank of England, that's certainly fallen a lot over the last few years. The Bank of England actually publishes a report every so often which measures public satisfaction, and it actually appeared to go negative in 2021 and is still negative now. And looking back through the data, that's the first time it's been below zero in recent memory. I can see the data goes back to 1999 here. I guess that's to do with interest rates picking up. People don't like rates going higher, and they don't like high inflation.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And, you know, if there was a Bank of England with the same remit it's got now, of course it didn't have it then, in the 1970s, I think the dissatisfaction with the Bank of England would have been even worse than it is now. I think it's easy to forget how bad things were in the 1970s.
If the Bank of England was going to model its net public satisfaction, it would probably skew the model and adjust it for interest rates and say, actually, we're doing a good job. We're only minus 3% here.
Or the inflation-adjusted popularity, yeah.
And it's an interesting question of whether any central bank could have actually prevented an inflation spike coming out of the pandemic. Could they have stopped it, you know, rising to that 9, 10, even 11% level that we saw in the UK? I mean, let's say their models were really accurate and it said, wow, inflation's going to get up above 10%. Would the central bank even have wanted to smash up interest rates really high straight away to try and crush demand and prevent that? I don't think so.
Yeah, you can't stop supply chain disruption by raising interest rates. So a lot of it was exogenous, the big shock. It came from outside the UK economic system. They can only control stuff which is second round effects with interest rates. So yeah, sure. Once the fire was started, the job is to stop it getting anchored and staying high. And their monetary policy, I think, played a part. But I think overall, yeah, you're right. I don't think they could have stopped it in any way.
And then the invasion of Ukraine and the energy spike really taking off after that. Again, not something the central bank can really influence.
Yeah, and they stress this all the time. So if you listen to the Bank of England's narrative, they'll say, look, you know, we couldn't affect things like an oil price shock or a gas price shock, or the way that gas and electricity are priced in the UK with a weird capping system. So all of that fed into the spike in inflation, and it was specific to the UK, some of those factors.
But that said, the report does sort of make clear that those exogenous factors, sure, you can't model them really. You don't know if Putin's going into Ukraine or not. You don't know if he's going to turn off the gas taps. But even accounting for that, it found serious flaws in the bank's modelling process, which does impact how it communicates with the public and how it makes its policy decisions.
And the key point here is about conditional forecasts. And again, you listen to one of the Monetary Policy Committee's press conferences, painful as it is, and they will stress this. They'll always talk about conditionality. And when they're talking about the forecast, they're very careful to explain, look, these are the forecasts, this is what it's conditioned on, and this is how we approach it. And one of the big conditioning assumptions is the price of energy, which they usually take from the forward market, from the futures market, which isn't necessarily a good way to do it. You know, I think a bit of human judgment there wouldn't be a bad idea. And if there's something which is absolutely obvious, according to the way they approach it, they are constrained in terms of what human judgments they can put into the model. And I think that's a limitation, and one of the ones which Bernanke pointed out.
And the bigger point, I think, here was that one of the key inputs is actually what the market expects interest rates to be in the future, as in where it thinks bank rates going to be from the Bank of England. And in the Bank of England's model, it uses the market expectation of interest rates rather than what it thinks it's actually going to set the interest rate to.
Which doesn't make a lot of sense on the face of it, because we have to assume that they know more about where policy rates will be than the market does.
And it's different to how other central banks do it. For example, the Federal Reserve actually publishes a projection of where each of its policymakers thinks interest rates are going to be in the future. Whereas the Bank of England is really reluctant to do that.
A lot of people hate it. A lot of economists hate it because it's not a forecast. It is just individual people's beliefs about what's going to happen in the future. But I think as a tool of communication, to get an insight into what the policy committee's thinking, it's very valuable.
And surely as an institution, if you're producing an economic projection using a model, the interest rates that go into that model should be your own views on interest rates, right? You're the ones that are going to be setting them. It shouldn't just be what the market's guessing.
And you can do both. You can say, look, this is what the futures market thinks about interest rates, and this is what we think about interest rates, and these are the two model forecasts conditioned on those two things.
And in fact, Bernanke's report really says that the Bank of England should be presenting more alternative forecasts to the market rather than just one central case. And it explicitly calls out the fact that the bank's forecast, and I quote, does not necessarily represent the committee's best guess of what will actually happen to the economy because of this conditionality that we've talked about. And I think we're guilty of it as much as anything, Romin, because sometimes we go, oh, the Bank of England is forecasting a recession, for example, that will last 2 years. But really, they're not. They're saying it would be a recession that lasts 2 years if the market's right about interest rates and we do what the market thinks. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in November 2022, where the bank's projection of a long drawn out recession was because the market curve implied higher interest rates going forward than the bank's policymakers actually thought was going to happen.
And it's not just monetary policy assumptions which can be properly conditioned on. It's fiscal policy as well, what the government's going to spend. And of course, that's never known more than a couple of months in the future. But Bernanke makes a nice point. So, for example, he says in November 2022, for example, the Chancellor announced continuation of current support to household energy bills to February 2023, and that some form of support would remain thereafter, but did not specify its nature. The MPC therefore made a working assumption about the nature of that support in its forecast ahead of details about the extent of support. So that's a really nice example of how they can step into the machine, as it were, and build in information which is known about fiscal policy in future.
And assumptions of what's going to happen. But in fact, I think they explicitly say that's the only time that's ever happened.
Yeah.
They're really reluctant to sort of front run government policy. And it's annoying because the government deliberately doesn't announce things that everyone knows is going to happen. And therefore, the Bank of England can't forecast properly. So, for example, the obvious example, every year, statute says that fuel duty, as in the tax you pay on the petrol that goes in your car, is going to rise by a certain amount. And then all projections are based on this escalating tax. But then every single year you get to the budget for the last decade or so, and the government says, woohoo, we've frozen fuel duty, and therefore invalidates all of the economic models that have been made.
It reminds me of what Douglas Adams said about sheep being stupid. You can tell they're stupid because every day they're surprised when the sun comes up. And it's kind of like that. You know, the MPC, in its modelling approach, by trying to be objective, is ignoring these obvious things. Even when the whole MPC doesn't think something's going to happen or does think it's going to happen, they can't factor that in.
This is where it needs to change, though. They need to truly embrace their independence from government and say, we don't believe what you're telling us, government, about your spending plans. We're going to go on what we think is a best guess you're actually going to do.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Freetrade, the UK commission-free investing platform. Freetrade has recently launched a revolutionary product, UK Treasury Bills, and it's only available on their platform for the UK market. What are Treasury Bills, you may ask? These are short-term debt instruments similar to gilts. They're backed by the UK government, which makes them a safer alternative to other assets. And with central bank interest rates this high, these currently offer competitive returns. Get direct access to 1 month UK Treasury Bills and earn annualized returns of 5% or more with Freetrade. And right now, Freetrade is offering UK Treasury Bills fee-free until April 2024. Head over to freetrade.io/treasurybills to get started today. Rate subject to success in tender. The rate changes at every weekly tender, forecast is not a reliable indicator of future performance. Capital is at risk, other charges may apply.
So just stepping back and thinking about the modelling process, obviously the Bank of England has a core piece of software which they use to build their economic model, which projections are based on, and that's called Compass. And that can only be as good as the data going into it. And as we've just said, some of that data is known to be wrong at the time it goes in. But even having said that, Bernanke's report says that the software itself leaves a lot to be desired, as in it's kind of out of date, it's not adequately maintained, it's not stress tested enough, and it has to kind of be bodged together with loads of manual processes.
It's a very 80s model. It uses what's called a dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model. But really, this one is quite clunky and it really doesn't adjust quickly enough, I think, to changes in patterns of consumption that we see in society. So maybe it's time to move on beyond that, I think, was what Bernanke was saying.
I mean, one thing he points out is that Compass is known to have a tendency to predict over rapid returns of the economy to its steady state equilibrium, including 2% inflation. So it's kind of an auto mean reverting model. It says everything's going to be all right if we don't know anything else.
Which the bank probably likes, but it's not very realistic. And he, I think, quite reasonably says that sectoral models, where you've got a specific model for a specific sector, for example, the construction sector, the financial sector, the housing sector, the energy sector, all of these could have their own model and therefore will produce a more granular and accurate report, factoring in specific information about that sector.
I think they have some of those models on the side, which they use to override parts of Compass. And that's the thing that you read again and again in the report, is that this system has grown up organically over time, and it's kind of a patchwork of models which don't talk to each other well. And he says the reason the bank finds it so hard to improve this system is because the staff are spending all their time just sort of cranking the gears and getting it to turn out the forecast every quarter.
I think the word he used, which I loved, was incrementalism. You know, you don't want to break the thing, but you've got to change it slightly in order to get what you want out of it.
Yeah, and I think the point he made with incrementalism was that their starting point for each new forecast is, well, let's take the last forecast we did and tweak it a little bit. I think he says that's not necessarily a bad way of doing it, but it might underestimate big structural changes in the economy. Obviously, we've seen a lot of those lately.
Also, as time goes on, technology makes wider sets of data available, and almost real-time data in some cases. And if you had to build those into the model, I think it just wouldn't be possible.
One of the things that he highlighted and sort of said, this is mental. Well, no, he didn't actually say this is mental. That was the implication, was that the Compass system has an assumption that long-run inflation expectations are fixed at 2%. They're always well-anchored, to use the central bank jargon. And therefore always assumes inflation will eventually return to target because everyone thinks the central bank is credible. And that isn't true. Like, central bank credibility fluctuates all the time. And the market's view of long-run inflation isn't always well anchored to 2%.
So assuming you're credible to start with, I think, is not very credible itself.
Because we've talked before about how what people think is going to happen to inflation seems to be weirdly important to what actually does happen to inflation.
And this anchoring thing is really important, but it's almost impossible to predict how people's views about inflation will evolve. And mostly that's done through surveys, because ultimately all of these economic models are based on predictions of human behavior, which is tricky, as we know. It's not like modeling a physical system, which you can do very accurately.
So as I understand it, the reason inflation expectations are particularly important is because they affect so many people's decisions. If you think inflation is going to be really high, presumably you're going to be trying to negotiate a higher salary and a pay rise or move jobs to find one, or you will be less willing to accept a low returning asset. You'll want some kind of inflation linkage. So a lot of behavior potentially changes if people expect inflation to be 5 or 6% versus 2%.
And for companies too, if you think your input costs are going to carry on growing at 5, 6%, then you'll be very willing to put up your prices. Whereas if you think, oh, it's just going to be high for a while and then it'll come back to normal rates of growth, that'll produce a very different set of outcomes in terms of behavior. And all of this is human judgment and very difficult to predict. So, you know, I think if you can build in survey-based information rather than making model assumptions, that would probably improve things, would be my guess.
I mean, why are these economic forecasts so important? You've said that the Fed has, in a way, stepped back a bit from all these forecasts and is just looking at the data as and when it comes in, potentially with a more short-term view, I guess. So why are we getting so hung up on whether the bank is accurately forecasting inflation and unemployment 12 to 24 months into the future?
I think that's a good point. You know, I think personally that they'd be better off depending on models a lot less. And just as the Fed does, they produce forecasts, but they don't take them very seriously. That should be their approach. I love the quote from George Box, the statistician, who said, "All models are wrong, some models are useful." So I think you're right. I think that essentially it's knowing when to ignore the models. Maybe they should structure that, you know, say, well, if the judgment of the committee is that the model's forecast is invalid, then these are the conditions under which we'll override the model forecast. They did that quite recently, in fact. For example, they were talking about why inflation was sticky and the fact that people, but also companies, were trying to recoup some of their income and kept price growth higher for longer in order to do that. That wasn't in the models that they had because they assumed a completely rational set of actors. So they overrode the model and assumed inflation would be stickier than it actually was according to the model.
This is something that Bernanke calls out, though. He says these kind of ad hoc adjustments, like, you need it, right? You can't just trust the model blind. But maybe the bank does it a bit too often and not so systematically. And this is one reason why, I'm sorry to disappoint you, Romin, he says the fan charts, which you use all the time, they've got to go. He says, put them in the bin.
I love those fan charts.
Why doesn't Bernanke like them then?
So he tried to be nice about it, but of course that made the criticism more damning in a way. He said, despite their distinguished history, the fan charts, as published in the MPR, the Monetary Policy Report, have weak conceptual foundations, convey little useful information over and above what could be communicated in other, more direct ways, and receive little attention from the public. Surely not true.
Is no one paying attention to your live streams?
They should be eliminated, he says. Shame.
Why do you love them so much? What are these fan charts for people who don't know?
So instead of producing a single forecast which says this is what's going to happen, you also get kind of error bars, if you like, fanning out over time, hence the name fan chart, which show the uncertainty in the forecast. Now, all of that's very well if you construct them in some kind of structured way. But it turns out, I didn't realise this, the MPC has input into the fan charts themselves. So if they say, OK, this is our inflation forecast, but we think it's skewed to the upside, the risk, so inflation is likely to be higher than lower than our central case, then they just clutch the fan chart to increase the upper limit a little bit and not the lower limit.
Naughty.
Yeah, nobody likes a clutch.
I mean, to go back to the question of why are economic forecasts from the central bank important? I think it's because of that thing we've talked about before. There's a lag in the impact of monetary policy, right? If you hike rates now, it doesn't fully affect the economy for who knows how long, 12 months plus probably.
Yep, I think the lag thing is really important. It always forms part of monetary policy that you assume there's going to be a lagged effect of whatever you do. This is why, for example, Andrew Bailey recently said that they'll cut interest rates before we reach the 2% target because of the lag. But I think there's another larger point here, which is information as a monetary tool. If you're transparent and you signal to markets what you would do in future, then effectively the market reaction and the behavioural reaction does your job for you. So you don't actually have to tighten monetary policy. You just tell them or hint that you're going to tighten monetary policy. So I think that's why having the dot plots and other tools like speeches and general interviews with central bank monetary policy committee members is useful. There's actually a moniker for this. They called it open mouth operations, which was a kind of twist on the idea of open market operations, which is the asset purchases which a central bank does day to day.
And it's a good point. Like, central banks obviously have to communicate with the market Because what you don't want is the market getting way out of line with the central bank, and therefore there's going to be a big snap back at some point and a lot of volatility. But they also have to communicate to the public and keep them on side, because obviously sometimes central banks have to do unpopular things. And if the public doesn't understand why you're doing those things, it's going to turn on you.
But wait, Michael, couldn't you just tell people that they should be willing to be poorer? Wouldn't that be a good way of doing it?
That's one way of doing open mouth operations.
But I think you're right. I think the models are one form of communication, and it's important to get the model forecasts understandable. But how do you do that? How do you get a good model forecast onto the BBC News? And I thought the fan charts were a reasonable way to do it, but it's true, they're seldom quoted. So maybe the way to do it is to say, you know, here's one scenario based on this assumption, here's another scenario based on this assumption, and just show the extremes, because that's probably a good way to teach people, you know, how bad it could be if we're wrong.
Yeah, Bernanke calls that scenario modelling, and that's exactly what he recommends the bank do. So you have your central case, you say, this is what we think is most likely to happen. However, if we're wrong about energy prices and they go up twice as much as we think, now this is what's going to happen to inflation and to unemployment and to growth. He thinks the bank should lay out these specific conditionality statements and their impact. But he says the bank can't really do that at the moment because its systems are so bad that it takes all its effort to just produce the one forecast.
And the other point here is that there's something called a reaction function. So if this happens in the economy, this is what we'll do. That's really useful to know. So if you say, look, if energy prices double, we're going to have to raise rates for longer. And I think if people understand that, then when it actually happens, they're not going to turn around and say, the bank's incompetent, they're idiots, they don't know what they're doing. They said they weren't going to raise rates, but they did. You can say our policy is data dependent until you're blue in the face. But if you show these outcomes and how you would react, then you can always turn around and say, look, we told you that if this happened, this is what we'd do. And we did.
I mean, what we usually talk about is investment decisions that we make as individuals. How does all this stuff about the Bank of England and their forecasts and the flaws in their forecasts, how does that affect us as investors?
Well, if they get monetary policy wrong, we'll know about it. We really will. Let's say, for example, that they keep rates too high for too long and they stifle growth in the economy. Well, that's not going to be great for risky assets in the UK. If they cut rates too soon, then inflation could flare up again. So there's a huge number of errors that they could make in terms of policy. And we really do rely on the central bank not to screw it up. And, you know, to be fair, when there was a huge problem in the bond market, thanks to the Kwarteng Truss budget, then they did step in, the Bank of England, and essentially save the day with huge bond purchases. So when push comes to shove and there's an emergency, you can rely on the Bank of England to do the right thing. But I think there's a kind of culture within the bank which is broken. And you can see it in their website, which is broken. You can see it in their communications with the public, which I think are broken. And the lack of communication as well. Carting Andrew Bailey out into a corridor at the Bank of England and putting him on Instagram is not going to fix the problem.
That was their big announcement, wasn't it, last week? New Instagram channel for the bank?
That's right.
I mean, to the Bank of England's credit, they've published this report, which I imagine is more damning than they thought it was going to be when they commissioned it. And they published it publicly and have said they're going to adopt the 12 different recommendations as quickly as they can. That's a kind of transparency, which is commendable.
Yeah, and it's great to see that they are willing to change. But whether the Monetary Policy Committee and the press conferences are likely to change as a result, we'll have to see.
I think overall, though, the Bank of England and central banks generally are in a much better position than they were just a few decades ago. So it wasn't until 1997 that the Bank of England was granted full independence, really, from government. And I was reading an interesting piece from Mervyn King, who obviously ran the Bank of England not that long ago. And he said the culture was entirely different before independence, where politicians had a lot of influence on how the bank set policy. So if everything we say about the flaws in forecasting now, at least there are forecasts. From what King was saying, back then it was that the Treasury would get on the phone to the Bank of England and say, come to our desks. And it's like, the rates are going up or down or whatever. Now, you can tell me about your forecast later on. And he says that after a satisfactory reception of a budget, governments would reward themselves with a rate cut. And, you know, we don't really get that kind of thing now. The banks guard their independence fiercely.
Yeah, we've come a long way. And that's true of all central banks. I think if you just look at the history of the Fed as well, a lot of the attributes of the bank, which we take for granted, have been changed quite recently. Like the 2% target, that was essentially introduced by Bernanke. And that was as recently as 2012.
Yeah, I guess for everything we've said about how things could be improved, we've already come a long way. So there's a quote I like from that Mervyn King piece in the FT about the bad old times. And he says, "One chancellor I recall said at the outset of a meeting, 'I want to make it clear that interest rates are not going to change. But now that I've made that clear, I would like to hear the arguments.'"
Now, we've said that monetary policy is very important for investors, but how does it affect asset prices and the overall economy? If you want to learn more about that, then why not join our community? To find out how, go to pensioncraft.com.
Okay, today's dumb question of the week is, what is quantitative tightening?
So could you just say that again, Michael?
Come on, Robin, I've been trying to say it for about 5 minutes. Quantitative tightening.
So I could say that it's just the opposite of quantitative easing.
You could say it, I couldn't say it.
But that wouldn't help a lot of people. I think the thing to understand is that with quantitative easing, the idea is the central bank affects the short end of the interest rate curve. So they affect the 1 month, 2 month, 3 month, up to about 1 year, maybe even 2 year part of the yield curve. So when they raise interest rates, it raises the short end of the curve. When they cut rates, it cuts the short end of the curve. What they can't affect so easily are the 10-year, 15-year, 20-year, 30-year rates. And yet for companies, that's an important rate, because when they come to borrow, if they're borrowing for a 10-year period, they'll pay an interest rate, which is the government bond rate, plus some spread for their credit risk. So if you want to push that down and make borrowing cheaper for companies, but also for things like mortgages, the way that the central bank can affect yield curves further out is to buy those bonds. They can buy 10-year bonds and it pushes down the yield. In other words, the cost of borrowing. So that's what quantitative easing was.
QE. Can we call it QE from now on?
Okay, we'll call it QE. And then QT is when you do the opposite. So the crisis is over. You're starting to get rid of all of the assets on your balance sheet because you probably bought billions or trillions of dollars or pounds worth of your own domestic government bonds. The Bank of England owned about a third of the outstanding government bonds at one point. You've got to somehow unwind that set of purchases. You can either sell the bonds or just wait till they mature. But the overall effect is to push yields up, just as you push them down when you were buying the bonds. So for the Bank of England, they're trying to do that in a non-disruptive way while selling the bonds. So it's not an easy task, I don't think.
Why do they need to sell the bonds?
Well, they don't. And in fact, the Federal Reserve is just waiting for them to mature. Generally, the duration of debt in the US is shorter than it is in the UK. We tend to issue much longer dated bonds. So if we were to wait for our balance sheet, the central bank's balance sheet, to shrink, it would take much longer. So presumably they want to speed up the process, and that's why they're selling bonds. But they're adamant that it's not affecting or disrupting the UK gilt market. But I find that difficult to believe.
I believe the most recent gilt auctions were pretty oversubscribed, so maybe they can point to that in the short term.
But that's issuance of new debt. This is about the price of the existing stock of debt.
But presumably if the market couldn't really absorb all of that stuff, yields would go up and the auctions would be in much more trouble.
Yeah, there's still a brisk demand for UK gilts, so it's not that bad. But I think, is it at the margin making yields higher than they would be? Probably.
Isn't that the point? Part of the point?
Yeah, but you don't want to do it to too much of a degree. If yields shoot up, that's the real problem. And true, that hasn't happened. So, you know, the disruption's minor.
But is there a reason that the central bank needs to shrink its balance sheet? Does the Fed even need to let these bonds mature and step out of buying?
Well, an interesting aspect of this, and one that Jerome Powell was actually discussing internally at the Fed, was they didn't want to make losses on their bond purchases. And that was because of politics. it looks really bad if you're making billions of dollars of losses or billions of pounds of losses, which the Treasury has to bail out. And by allowing the bonds to mature at par, you'd minimise those losses. Whereas the Bank of England is selling a lot of long duration debt at huge losses and having to be bailed out by the Treasury.
And when you say bailed out by the Treasury, do you mean we're effectively taking taxpayer money and giving it to the Bank of England to plug the hole?
Yeah, exactly that. And that's why I think, you know, there's a real problem if the bank has to do that, because if you're going to make out that you're politically independent, having those losses allows politicians to kind of cosh you over the head and say, look, you're incompetent. You bought these at a high price, you're selling them at a low price, and you're generating lots of losses, which we have to bail out.
No one was complaining when the Bank of England was remitting a load of cash to the Treasury, though, were they?
No, it goes both ways. But of course, politicians won't talk about that. You know, they won't talk about the gains. They'll only talk about the losses. But that was the worry, that it's going to somehow make it harder for the central bank to stay independent because of the political pushback. Another reason, I guess, is that they'll have some dry powder. So if things go bad again, they'll have the ability to expand the size of their balance sheet again. Whereas if you're already maxed out, although there is no maximum limit, but if you own a third of your own bond market, then going to the next level and owning two thirds or 80% or 90% of your bond market is not a good look.
There is a maximum limit. It's the total amount of issuance. I mean, you laugh, but you know, if you plotted it out, right, you could in theory end up there. Nothing left to buy.
I know for certain issues, they owned more than 100% of some of the bonds.
What? Sorry? Was in the bonds had been lent out and they bought them back again? What?
I think that's why it was, yeah.
Or in the repo.
Because of the repo market, yeah.
I mean, some people say that the way to think of QE versus QT was that QE was just adding loads of liquidity to the bond market, right? And to markets in general. Money was being printed and it was going into markets. Asset prices were going up, up, up. Obviously, that then makes us think QT, are we tightening liquidity, pulling money out of the market? Is there going to be a kind of dislocation, is the word I've seen used a lot, where asset prices could suddenly fall?
That's a risk. And you imagine that the government at the same time is having to fund lots of spending programs because taxation's at the highest level it's been since the Second World War in the UK. And if they're going to spend money on services and infrastructure, it has to be paid for somehow. And so the issuance calendar for the UK is going to be brisk for some time. And if people step back from that market and say, look, I don't want any more debt, thank you very much, then yeah, it's a real problem having to do quantitative tightening at the same time as people stepping back from those gilt auctions.
We'll see, I guess. I think the interaction with inflation will be interesting, because I remember at the time coming out of the 2008 crisis, where really for the first time in history, central banks started QE, printing loads of money and buying loads of debt. And people were worried it was going to cause a massive inflation spike. It didn't. I remember that Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, who did this review of the Bank of England, back in the day, he said, the problem with QE is it works in practice, but it doesn't work in theory, which is an interesting quote. So who knows how QT is going to work and how it will impact inflation?
I don't think we know. And I think that's the scary thing about it, because it hasn't been done before. The Federal Reserve balance sheet's never been beyond $9 trillion before. But, you know, they're shrinking it at a fair old clip now, roughly $1 trillion per year, just over.
I think the point you made was right, though, that it's really to build dry powder for the next crisis. We're just selling off a bit until we inevitably start QE again at some point. The world will find a way. Thank you for joining us for Many Happy Returns. Do send us your questions, no matter how dumb, at the email address mhr@pensioncraft.com.
And do remember to check out pensioncraft.com for all the information about our membership and investment coaching options.
Many Happy Returns is a PensionCraft production, co-hosted and executive produced by Romy Nakiza and Michael Pugh. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes and is not financial advice. We do not provide recommendations or endorse any decision to buy, sell, or hold any security. We cannot be held responsible for any actions listeners may take, and investors are encouraged to seek independent financial advice.